Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. Thank you once again for those of you who have sent in the responses, the question answers for you, and the suggestions about what would be most helpful. It's very helpful to me in guiding our discussion. This seminar, we're going to begin discussing the roadmap system. It's the acronym for the seven steps to understand a story, to revise it, and or to create a new story. Now, these are the fundamental principles of writing your own story, whatever that applies to, whether it's your life story, wellness, relationship, leadership, money story, whatever the application is, the principles are the same. It's very much like when you do your fundamental coach training, the fundamental tools, methods, principles, and skills developed are there as a bedrock for whatever you apply those principles to, whatever niche or whatever area you coach. So one way of thinking about this is the roadmap system, that it's a macro system that I've evolved over time that I want to share with you, and it's in your outline, and we're going to talk about each of the steps. These are the fundamental ways to understand the algorithms that you use in your brain. The 90 to 95% of your operating system that's unconscious, we're going to make it conscious. So you no longer got any excuses. We're going to look at this process and understand how you construct the stories. And we'll spend the remainder of our three seminars on this. I think it's that important. Now, here's something that goes alongside with the fundamental coaching model that we talked a little bit about last time to guide the conversation of a single session. Every algorithm that you, let's talk about you instead of just your client, every algorithm that you have that is important and still determines part of your present story will manifest in the conversation. If it's your coaching client, it's going to manifest in the conversation. And you may focus on the conscious things with the client and look at the strategies and the plan and all of that, but you're going to be hearing what the client uses to develop their story so that you're going to be hearing things that enhance that story. You're going to be hearing the things that the client may not even be aware of that interfere with that story. And part of that operating system that's unconscious may include limiting assumptions. Well, I have to be confident before I can do it. You know, I gotta have some experience with limiting beliefs, assumptions that no longer work but worked at one time. The various biases that we have, unconscious biases, inattention biases. This is a way to look at understanding a story and whatever is presented to you. And as mentor coaches, this is where you're going to earn your money, looking at the process and understanding together and developing that collaborative alliance to address these things that go into creating a story so that with a working alliance, you can get away with saying what you need to say to a client. Look at, in my blog archives, there's a blog that's titled Saying What We Need to Say, and there's an illustration of a demo coaching I did at a training for an organization that kind of gives a different perspective instead of going into that. Can I get a management of the background noise? If you're not about to talk, and I hope you are, would you mute, because the rustling of paper and the various ambient noise is a little bit distracting. So anything anybody would like to add or ask at this point or pose as a question for us to consider and wrap in. I appreciate those of you who have sent your biggest or most important takeaway also, and I hope you will each consider writing down, just for yourself, or sending it along, it's helpful to me, what's the most important thing you're taking away today? Remember, we talked about the output channel and how that's important. That's what we do with clients, and that's how we end a session, to look at what their most important takeaway is and what they commit to do out loud, because they're going to much more likely follow through when they commit to you. So anything any of you want to add or ask while we have an open mic? Or anybody just want to check
in? Yeah. Hi, this is Anne. I wanted I wanted to ask about the workbook. I started it last week after class and just wanted to get an idea over time, certainly not right away, but like how it all is incorporated and how that's used with a client. What's the most effective way, in conjunction with what we're going through in these seminars, to use that material?
Okay, that's a good question. And I included it for you, as I do, like the roadmap, as well as the whole aspects of the workbook, for your use, for you as an organizer. It's not something I've ever given to a client to use, although it's very possible. If you and it's something that is proprietary. The people who have done the New Life Story Wellness Training and are licensed and specially certified have it as a use that they do, like in groups or organizations or that sort of thing. But I included it just so you could get an idea, and ideally for our purposes right now, just to go through the workbook and the steps as we are talking about them in the seminars, to go through and pick some exercises that may be representative or maybe something you feel you need to work on in a more structured way. So the overview is the seven steps are a way to understand the process of how we go about making decisions and think about and behave in certain ways to develop more of a reflective awareness of that. And the workbook exercises are simply to crystallize an awareness of that, or maybe amplify a specific aspect that may be something that you want to get a little bit more perspective or understanding of. So for right now, I'd say track the exercises along with the seminars just to see if it's useful to you.
Okay. Thank you.
And specifically, I would suggest each of you look at, I think this is, I'll have to look, see if it's the needs and ideals exercise. That's something that I almost with every client I do mentor coaching, I'll send the needs and ideals exercise, because I think it's helpful for both of us to get an idea of their fundamental needs and their fundamental ideals, and to see if the strategy and story we're developing are consistent with those, because there are times when someone's strategy and story is not consistent with their fundamental needs and ideals, their bedrock of identity and core needs. And it's useful to both of us to have that. It's something I put inside the folder of each client I work with, the top three needs and top three ideals. So I think it'll be helpful to be clear about that, to be sure that all of you is going in the same direction. So let's come back to that after we've talked a little bit more and see if there's a refinement that we need, or if I can be a little clearer about that, or get your input about your questions about what is and isn't helpful. Okay, so, Anne, that's a good question. I appreciate it. Does that sort of, for right now, answer your question?
Yes, Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm,
right,
definitely.
So it's a good question, mm-hmm. too, especially as we launch into the first four steps in the roadmap, this seminar. Any other thoughts or questions or additions from anyone? Okay, well, I'll reserve a bit of time at the end for discussion, so I'm going to go on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about any noise, and talk about the first four steps, and then we'll have a brief discussion, and I'll get your input or any clarifications first. Okay, we're in presentation mode now. So we've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now we're going to look closely at how to do that, the principles and practice of change. We'll examine the seven steps in the roadmap process to create a new wellness story. Now, these seven steps are a deconstruction and understanding of the algorithms that drive thought, feeling, and action. It's a systematic way of constructing an understanding and revision, perhaps even new story. So it's a system of understanding in stepwise change, integrating the psychology and neuroscience of strategic coaching. So this focus will be on wellness story, and it could be on any one of the other stories that are possible. So the roadmap is simply the acronym for recognize authorship, own your story, this is all in your outline, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map wellness strategies, author new experiences, and program and incorporate in a working model of how and who you are this process of identity. We're going to come back to that because this is a really important step. Now, each step is simple, but it's not really easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it often requires us to change the way we think about our lives. And remember, whenever we have a belief, a fact, information, that's an anatomical reality in our brains. So, again, this is to reiterate just a bit, but if, as a coach, you present a different idea or a different belief or try to run in a play or give advice to your client, they're going to immediately compare what they already believe or know with what you say. If it fits, they're going to find a way to confirm it, confirmation bias. If it doesn't fit, they're going to find a way to refute it. This means that what is termed in neuroscience the boomerang effect. Whatever belief they have, whatever that anatomical reality is in their brain to start with, after you present something, it's going to be stronger. They're not going to suddenly take in new information and say, this is how I need to change my life. That's not the way our minds and brains work. So this is a different way of doing things. And remember, we talked and applied this last time. When you really want someone to change, you engage them first by asking a question, not by telling, advising, facts, data. And then you look together at creating a map to begin this process. So here's the overview. The first three steps are about awareness. It's a systematic way to ask questions. Step one, recognize authorship. And again, we're going to apply consistently your wellness story. Now, remember the premise. Each moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important enough. But they're not enough. That's why I made a transition from psychiatry and psychoanalysis after 25 years into mentor coaching to begin to help people write a new story instead of coming to the end of the past. you have to create a new or revised story. So, how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know which aspects work and which need to change? Let me, as a margin note here, answer one of the questions. How do you bring up wellness story? I would ask about it. You know, I would, if it appears in the needs or ideals, that's an easy way to collaborate about that. If it's not, at some point, early on, I would like to know what do you do for your own wellness, or do you work out? How do you think about your wellness and fitness? Just to ask a question. So here are four principles in recognizing authorship. First principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Here's a brief example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. So this baby elephant stays in the area determined by the length of the rope. When the elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, and that situation still stands, despite all reason otherwise, it could easily break the rope, but it doesn't, because earlier as a baby, it couldn't. This 5 to 6 ton adult elephant is constrained by its assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines the behavior then. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Second principle. We don't see things the way they are. We see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. And we construct our storylines from these premises and this process from our screening programs in our software packages. We have to change our beliefs or bring our belief first into conscious focus to assess how well they work. We don't get what we want. We get what we expect because we always make our beliefs come true. You act in a way to teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and it validates your assumptions. Third principle, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. This is the choice architecture of mentor coaching. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intention, you can affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of they're going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question in the next 3 months increased purchase rates 35%. Our behaviors and other behaviors with increased frequency asking if they intend to work out, asking how they determine their exercise or their diet. So, when you get ready to ask your client and they make a commitment, state your intentions. Be specific. Write it down. The stated intention is more powerful when coupled with a specific action plan. Henry Ford said, you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. So that's where a good idea needs to go into the formation of a plan. And we'll return to that because there was one really excellent question that was sent in about that. Fourth principle, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect, because this creates a closure. We don't have to worry or think about it or create any openness, which the brain experiences as a bit of energy that has to be applied. So if you ask somebody, you know, why do you do this, they'll immediately tell you. Now, more likely than not, it's not cause and effect, but it creates a closure without further examination. So this is also why your client wants you to make a suggestion or give an advice. Never mind that they're not going to take it, but it brings closure for both coach and client. So that cognitive dissonance of the exploration and keeping it open is not there anymore. So to create a complete closure of a story and a sense of effectiveness can trump accurate. That's why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth, a finish without an ending. So our minds seek closure and infer causality, accurate or not. That's really important. Look at this exercise in step one in the workbook with this in mind. Recognize authorship of your story. It's on page 1.5. And look at how you may think about examining that to recognize authorship. Step two, own your story. Review for this on page 1.7 in the workbook, assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. So from an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see, how we process it, and then the decisions that we make. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet or a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. And that's what we talked about last seminar. If you really want to change or to facilitate change with your client, focus not just on the goal, but on the process of change and do it systematically. What really will most facilitate change is creating a system. And we talked about, remember, the simple coaching model being a system of a coaching conversation. So as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that might be helpful. And this is in your outline too. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So here are some empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to exercise 6 days a week. Here are some limiting beliefs. Well, I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Each of these last examples, in my view, are a coachable moment. That's why I ask, as I mentioned, every client I work with, may I interrupt you if I think it might be helpful for both of us to look at something at that moment, give them permission to interrupt me. I can't find time to exercise. That's a limiting belief. Why go on further and not even give a nod to that belief that is going to interfere with writing a story? Notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. So first, you have to frame this as a choice rather than just the way things are. So a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that notion by talking about point of reference and active versus passive. The point of reference is a basic component of story writing. This is why we always, with a client, focus on the client's story, not superimposing our story or running in a play. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. They may transfer a responsibility to someone or something outside of themselves. They may react to situations they're in. So here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference. Another way to say this, here is a list of coachable moments. They may feel as if they have little control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They may feel vulnerable to the responses of others, and their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating, reacting rather than initiating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanged. Well, that's just the way I, as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Now, you can probably tell some of these examples are really easy for me to say. When they experience a symptom in their body, they medicate it away. That's like turning off the warning light on the dash of your car. Those with an internal point of reference, this is what we coach toward, see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. This is the essence, the bedrock of a growth mindset. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. So here are some characteristics. They recognize accountability for their lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. They see themselves as the point of reference, as the protagonist in their own story, not somebody else ghostwriting. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result, then look for alternatives. This is also what we do with clients. And this is why the collaborative model is so important, the sense of the we-ness, of the client and you doing it together so that you're not perceived as judgmental or critical or authoritative in some way, but in a collaborative way. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they realize the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. So this is that juncture that we touched on last time. And I just want to reiterate again, how you frame something determines the mindset you use to process the remainder of that issue. If you see something as a problem, boom, that's a mindset, and whatever happens, whatever questions or exploration of the problem goes into an already existing pathway in your brain. If instead you frame it as opportunity, as challenge, then you initiate a very different process to look at possibility. And again, your brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. How you frame it determines whether you go backward, protect yourself, anxiety better head for cover, or whether you look at it as what's the next step, what's the possibility here to create the openness to explore. And that creates new neuronal networks and pathways in your brain. So a related notion, recognize active versus passive positions. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. This seems to just keep happening. So each of these are coachable moments. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So these can be examined to look at writing a different story in a collaborative way. So once recognizing and owning your wellness story, step 3, assess the storylines and the plot. This is where distinguishing and addressing the ideals in the workbook 1.12 and needs, workbook beginning 1.14. So a brief overview. Ideals and needs are at the core of our identity, part of the foundation of self. Ideals serve as a personal model of value, an internal guide to purpose and value. Now, here's what's important, although it's not something we necessarily deal with in coaching, but just so you know, living up to a personal attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. This is what you'll see. This is what you'll be aware of. So I think it's important to recognize. Now, on the other hand, failure to live up to an internal ideal results in a feeling of shame. And that's important. Not guilt, but shame. Not living up to an attainable internal ideal. Not perfect, not more, neither of those are goals. And a need is an essential requirement, a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. So of all, as I mentioned, all the exercise and tool, needs and ideals assessment is the one that I actually use most from this workbook. This is a sidebar totally. The use of this workbook for a coaching group can be very useful, and we'll return to that. So part of the assessment of your wellness story is to understand conflicted or contradictory storylines. When you feel one part of the brain playing with another, you need a map. So a paradigm, which is also a way of saying a mindset. It's a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. Simply the way we see the world. Now, what we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The map explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We often are not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. And remember this, and I've mentioned it before, I want to reiterate here. This idea of story is for your processing. My sharing it is one of the ways to process hearing material to understand what will be a collaborative venture to help your client understand themselves better. The client isn't presenting a story. They're presenting, this is the way things are. So your challenge is to collaborate, to look at that, and especially to look at that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's unconscious, because unconscious means they don't see it, but they can be aware of it. And the principle here is, once you've illuminated and discussed something that's unconscious, it's no longer unconscious. So here's a simple example of how the brain has a mind of its own, and that we're often of two or more minds. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's set up an exercise and plan a savings program. Well, the limbic system says, let's have that cheesecake now, especially with the strawberry topping, and order the big screen HD and plasma TV, both. Each struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. So our self-awareness is so important. How we self-reflect and how we help our clients develop that awareness. That is a fundamental, this is the bedrock of what we do with a working alliance with our clients. We help them develop a way to collaboratively look together to ultimately develop self-empathy, to look at their experiences, what they can feel and experience as objectively as possible, and then together craft a way of how they want to change and a systematic way to do it. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. in your wellness story? Is all of you going the same direction? Does each storyline advance the plot? But you got to have a plot. So listen to your self-statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of beliefs and personal reality. And here's a thought about self-statements. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, a group, a culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like and dislike in a situation or in another person, and don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Another, listen for repetitions of the own of your story. Recognizing and owning the story is necessary, prerequisite to assessing changes. And remember, whatever remains unconscious is most likely to be attributed to fate. Another way of looking at that, you're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So look at what works and do more of it. Look at what doesn't work to really understand and revise it in the way you want. An example here, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. You may even want to do a visualization here. This is also why the vast majority, over 95% of people who lose significant weight gain it back plus 2 to 3 pounds. Why? They change their body, they change what they do, but they don't change their body image. And we always go back to the power of our mind and brain, in this instance, the body image. So listen to your language. And there's a visualization exercise in the addendum. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be building a trapdoor, an out. So you know the words of somebody who's not going to do something. I need to, I'll try, I should, I ought to. Here are the words, and this is from your coaching conversation at the end when you frame with the client and ask what they commit to. A commitment begins with, I will. And remember, SMART goals has a T, so ask by when. Now, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it, feel it when you eat healthily, when you work out and rest well, at the time and later. So a huge, delicious dessert will taste great at the moment. Strawberry topping on that cheesecake. But it's been shown that about 80 to 85%, this is what I use anyhow, 80 to 85% of the taste is going to be in the first 2 or 3 bites. So why be redundant and do something that may not be good for you? After that, it's redundant. Your body is already accommodated to the same to the sensation. Same principle with Coke addicts. Not the soft drink, who describe they chase the first high of that initial use for the rest of their addictive process. So listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works objectively and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much, when you eat foods that are unhealthy, or drink too much. It is not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, it is immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. symptoms get disguised and use a disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. The symptom is a sentinel of a process that needs, that begs to be understood, to be listened to rather than silenced, to be respected rather than disregarded. A symptom is a storyline that needs to be heard until it's translated. Somatic language, literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meanings. Milrad Pavic said, it's easier to fall ill than to learn the truth. So take care of your maladies. You are the author, not the victim of any symptom you have. And this is psychological symptom. I hope you're with me and not thinking of the exceptions that will apply, because they will. When you listen to whispers, again, to repeat, your body doesn't have to shout. We're talking about the whole spectrum of wellness and staying within that. So step four, decide what to change. Have for reference the first exercise of Module 2, four basic requirements for storybook evaluation, page 2.4, and have handy the exercise 15 reflections to understand your storyline, workbook page 2.10. And a precept for this step. Part of the struggle for people who embrace change is because the methods to embrace change are often contrary to how the mind and the brain work. So despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, many people don't make change even when they know it's in their best interest. Your identity is not your behavior, not your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it'll be harder to change. People become the stories of who they think they are. Now remember this principle from step two. In adulthood, you either create your reality or agree to it. For this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. So let's look at what's involved in deciding to change, to author new experiences. How does the brain oppose change? This is crucial to understand. Our minds and brains automatically resist change. Here's some application. Change creates discomfort. This is in your outline, at least the overview of it. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting somebody to decide what to do or to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. And activities that we repeat become hardwired. So think about this. Every time your client takes one step into something that's new and different, it's going to be attendant with some kind of discomfort, even a slight register of trepidation, anxiety, uncertainty. This is where we as mentor coaches can help them frame that experience that is a register from the brain that, you know, the error detection mechanism says, this is not right, this is not what I expect, and it's a step into the new and unknown because you do not have a pattern for that yet. If the client reads it as my intuition is telling me this is not the right thing or my gut tells me I'm making a mistake, that's a framing error. So we will want to help the client, I think, understand that trepidation or that difficulty or simply to empathically resonate, no, I hear how each step or I hear how this can be uncomfortable because it's different beyond where you've been before. And here's the reframing that I'm saying. This is back to me talking to you, you not talking to the client. Here's the reframing. This is an indication of taking a new step that you're unfamiliar with. So it will create uncertainty. Consider that this is a signpost of being in new territory, the validation of moving ahead. So that's a very different framing than anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, or my gut's telling me I'm doing the wrong thing. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change, to preserve the default habit. That's what your client has been doing and why your client needs you. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know it yet, so our minds have to lead the way, and that's why we're looking at one system to do this. Two, change creates discomfort, dissonance, let's say. Change creates dissonance, discomfort. Couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine because it's hardwired. It's what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. And this activates the brain's error detection mechanism, as I mentioned, and reads as if something's wrong. And this error detection mechanism is an actual place in the brain located very close to the emotional center. So this registers as a sense something's not quite right. The good news? The brain contains neural machinery in this same area, the medial frontal cortex, to recognize and correct errors, to optimize behavior. This means that these brain neurons become active after negative feedback or diminished reward, so it also responds to mistakes. Now, this is great, but we have to distinguish whether it's a mistake or a neural response and printout to change itself. That's where your understanding of this comes in with a client. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. I want to give you some numbers. Write these down if you want, I suggest you write them down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Maybe 3 and 6, multiples of 3? Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there in that list of 6. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. J. Paul Getty said there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how the brain prediction of patterns is also the basis of some jokes, listing 2 things and a third non sequitur. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make a wise and balanced decision. This is where having a system is essentially necessary. How the brain opposes change? 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back on the problems that create. We get what we focus on. Recognition for someone being on time, back to the focus that raises anxiety and reinforces the patterns associated with lateness. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do, as I mentioned, results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. That includes you, the coach. 5, motivation is not essential. This gets to one of the questions that you sent in, and I'll get to it more specifically. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And all it takes is a plan and to stick to it. Many of the pro athletes and actors I've worked with, they get up in the morning, they go to the gym, they aren't motivated to do it, but they do it anyhow. And sometime during the course of the workout, they may really get into it, but they do it regardless. They have a plan and they stick to it. Motivation is not essential. 6, emotions change brain functioning. For example, when emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. Whatever emotion it is, and the stronger, the more it hijacks. Threat produces, for example, adrenaline, stress chemical, cortisol. Function shifts away from the forebrain. 7, stimulation and performance. A little bit of stress, stimulation, enhances memory and learning. But the things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short-term and enhance learning. The window, though, is maybe up to 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, stress can make things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So people with sustained stress can make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy, and this is from Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review, studying executives, regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. More than title, positions, training, degrees, and this was only because executives were studied. I think it's that for everyone. So, how the brain opposes change, there's a closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Major factor, not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as a certain business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. This is our challenge, to open a closed system, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate that system. These last two principles, and I want to spend the rest of our time, and I apologize, we most likely will not have time for questions, so I'm going to ask you to send them in. Last two principles, I think, are huge for coaching. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is intellectual and emotional stimulation that creates more complex brain structure. That's what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with two things: creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases cells? Almost 100% increase by physical exercise, the number of cells in the hippocampus. Now, recently these findings were replicated in humans in non-invasive studies, London taxicab drivers and medical students at the University of Hamburg. About 15 to 18% with stimulating environment, intellectual and emotional, and essentially 100% by regular sustained exercise. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus, the site of memory and new learning, decreases. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. An example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, the usual practice for a long time was to put that arm in a sling so that there wouldn't be damage. However, when the good arm is put in the sling, so they're forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing, after 10 days of this, the patients regained significant use of an arm they thought would hang useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby neurons to perform the functions of the damaged one. Another example, not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same studies and findings in classical guitarists, the area of the dominant hand. The good news, we're not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways, and new neural networks, this can form a revision and new models, new highways to new communities in your brain. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So I want to conclude with what neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to your wellness story. And these are fairly simple, but I think they're really important. One, and this is a reiteration in a way. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge, though, can be the beginning of new knowledge when it's framed in that way. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way than by this initial framing and pursuit. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. Neuronal networks are a physical fact in the brain. They can't simply be removed or just overwritten by another fact or belief or supposedly a better way to do things. But they do atrophy with disuse as other networks take their place. But it's an inside job. A teacher or a mentor coach can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from someone's brain. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. We have to unlearn as well as learn. This is why fixing doesn't work, besides it changes the point of reference of the story. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network or expect they're going to download it. Four. Partly because it's complex and personal, and partly because it's subjective reality, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge or patterns. This is the 90 to 95% of our brains and of our operating systems, rather, that's unconscious. So here's a final story. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a coach. They did an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, they visualized, they wrote affirmations, they created a system and a plan. After a few hours, one penguin had a breakthrough and flew a short distance. Others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. We have just a moment or two for questions. I'm sorry we don't have more. Any thoughts or anybody want to share their takeaway? Any or all of the above? What you got? Anyone dare venture? Well, I will be interested if you want to think about it, put together. It's probably not an off-the-cuff thing, but I'll bet you know more than you're saying. send it to me in an email. What is the most important thing you're taking away? It'll help me get an idea. And any remaining questions or issues that you want to incorporate, and I'll find a way to talk about them. We may think about adding like a 15 minutes to the end of the final seminar for more of a discussion and any questions that you have not answered. I'll see how the thoughts and questions you have goes. Thanks for any feedback you have. I'll be very eager, and my apologies for not having a time for discussion at the end. But I'm very interested in hearing from you and any thoughts, questions, and your takeaways, any and all of the above. We'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. I appreciate it. See you guys.
Thank you, Dave.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Thanks.
Thank you. Have a good week. God bless you.